This is HPR episode 2478 entitled City of Masks, HPR Audiobook Club, and is part of the series HPR Audiobook Club. It is hosted by HPR Audiobook Club and is about 86 minutes long and carries an explicit flag. The summary is: the HPR Audiobook Club reviews City of Masks with author Mike Reeves McMillan.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by Archive.org. Support universal access to all knowledge by heading over to archive.org/donate.
Good evening and welcome to another edition of the Hacker Public Radio Audio Book Club. For our longtime listeners, you might notice that I am not the intrepid Pokey. He should be joining us later this evening. I'm your host for the evening, or panelist or something. I don't really know what I am. X1101. Tonight we're going to be discussing a book called City of Masks, and we're joined by actually the author of the book, Mike, as well as Semiotic Robotic. How you doing?
Hey, evening to both of you. Mike, thanks so much for being here. This is a real pleasure.
Seems like we've lost Mike for the moment, so we'll hold off till he joins back up. Mike, welcome back. You having some connection issues there?
Sorry, I accidentally muted on hardware, so that was why you couldn't hear me.
Oh, we've all done it. Anyway, thank you very much for joining us. It's a real pleasure. I don't think we've had very many authors join us for book club.
Well, my pleasure to come and join in. I'm looking forward to hearing what you thought about the book.
Both for you, Mike, and for the listeners, any listeners at home unfamiliar with our format, I'll just go over it again. We'll usually spend a little bit of time going over what we thought about the book without spoiling any of the plot. So we'll talk about general themes, general impressions, recording quality, sound quality, things like that. Then we'll break for a little bit and do a beverage review. We do deliberately call it a beverage review. We've got people who review beer, wine, hard liquor, tea, coffee, water. We've got all types. And then after that, we'll jump right in and, you know, the kitty gloves come off and we'll, you know, rip into the plot and spoil the crap out of it.
Sounds good.
So, Semiotic Robotic, let's start with you. What did you think?
I really enjoyed this book. I had to read the book instead of listen to the audiobook because I couldn't get the audiobook to work on my particular stereo setup, but I really enjoyed it. It was just a fantastic read. I just couldn't believe the finesse that Mike displayed here. I mean, the language was antiquated without sounding hokey. So many times I read books, I think, that try to sound antiquated and try to mimic a sort of older style, and they don't succeed, or they just sound a little forced. But there was something so natural about Mike's writing that I was floored. I was impressed.
Yeah, I mean, I thought the language felt very natural as well. I didn't even really occur to me that it was anything other than appropriate for the time period that this book seems to be set in.
You know, I was curious about that, had a question for Mike, if he had a particular time period in mind, if this was supposed to be a sort of alternate dimension, if there was some kind of, like, what he kind of conceived as the space and time of the novel.
Well, it's kind of Shakespeare's Italy, but not really. It's more or less late medieval, early Renaissance, but with lower technology, and the language itself is probably more 18th century with one or two medieval expressions in it. So I wasn't going for a particular place or a particular time, but it has hints of early Renaissance Venice being kind of the inspiration. It's kind of a Hollywood inspired by rather than a based on.
Right, that makes sense. I get you.
As a story consumer, so I can't really speak much at all as an author, but it seems like it would be easier. You could take more liberties if your targeting a fictional time and place rather than trying to write a novel set in a specific time and place, because you have more liberty to take the bits and pieces you like from this time period and that location, where if you were trying to say this was, you know, 14th century Florence, you have some pretty, you know, to be accurate, you've got some tight guidelines to follow there, whereas you can borrow this from this century and this from that location, and it gives you a broader playground. Does that sound about right, or am I off the mark there?
No, you're quite right. I'm very lazy about research, and so it's much easier just to make things up rather than try to be strictly historical. So,
but it also gives go ahead.
Carry on. I think of this as kind of a fantasy novel without magic, in that setting is like a made-up fantasy setting, a secondary world setting, but there's no actual magic in it.
Yeah, that was the...
So why choose it then? I'm curious what, I mean, in any time period, you could have masks in contemporary England, you could have masks in the 23rd century. So I'm just curious why you selected that particular epoch.
I enjoy Shakespeare. I try to go to live plays whenever there's one on. And masks to me suggests Venice. So those two things kind of came together and suggested a setting. It's not like Venice in that it doesn't have canals, but it is a harbor city and a trading city.
Well, many layers of walkways and layers of the city almost stands in for the canals in some ways.
Yes, that's true. So you've got
a good point. I hadn't thought about that.
You've got the low roads that are kind of below ground level and the high roads that are up the sides of the buildings. And yeah, that it is kind of like that.
As I was listening to it both times, I listened to it both right after our last audiobook club and then just last week, I kept wondering a lot of these things, specifically the genre, and your description of it's just about right. It's a fantasy setting without most of the typical fantasy elements.
Yeah, one of the things that makes it hard to market is that it doesn't have a clear genre. It's speculative fiction is about as clear as you can go.
Hey guys, sorry, I am late.
Just earning your nickname once again.
Yes, I haven't earned it yet. How you doing, guys? And Mike, nice to meet you.
Likewise.
Thank you so much for joining us this week. That's great of you to do.
Oh, no problem.
And Pokey, can you recall offhand how many times we've had other authors on?
I would say 3 times, but only one other time was the author there for their own book.
Okay, that's
Christiana.
Yes, sir. Christiana Ellis came on for her own book, and then 2 others came on, specifically didn't want to be on for their own book, didn't want to alter the conversation. I don't think they would have anyway, but either way.
I feel like a pioneer.
A what now?
A pioneer.
Oh, yeah, right on.
Pokey, we were just talking about Mike's decisions with regard to setting and style, and he was explaining to us sort of what he had in mind for what he sort of had in his imagination regarding, you know, the setting of the book.
Oh man, the setting. Can I jump in then?
Sure. Please do.
I just thought the setting was beautiful. All I could picture when listening to this was just this, you know, gilded and white lacy world, and you know, very tidy people. You know, of course, that all being just the veneer over the surface, but it was always beautiful, and I was able to picture it beautifully. I don't have a very active imagination, as I've said before in the show, when it comes to visualizing settings. But in this one, I think I could. It felt very much like, a Cask of Amontillado. I think that's how you pronounce it, Amontillado, by Poe. It kind of had that feeling to it the whole time, but deeper. It was fantastic. I loved it. I loved every moment of this audiobook.
I believe it's Cask of Amontillado.
I'll take your word for it. Thanks.
I'm looking it up for the show notes.
And I don't know. I thought the setting itself, just especially the 3 different layers of the city, the 3 different layers of setting, just did a real good job of shifting gears when gears needed to be shifted without grinding them too bad or slipping the clutch too bad. If it's a strange metaphor, I apologize.
I think a lot of what I was doing with that was, as well as with the masks, was making things that are usually internal and hidden open and visible. So the class structure in the city is reflected in the physical structure of the city. And the low people use the low roads and the high people use the high roads, as well as the masks revealing something about who people are as they're walking around. And of course,
you sound like you're a personalist.
Yeah, well, and the way in which masks reveal person or are the person, if you prefer, that was kind of the seed from which the book grew. There's an Oscar Wilde quote about how a mask is not there to hide somebody's identity, but to reveal it. It's something that I kind of had turning over in my mind as I was writing it.
I love the idea that whatever mood you were in that day, or perhaps whatever job you had to get done that day, you put that mask on, and everyone around you was required to treat you the way that mask dictated, and at the same time you were required to behave as the mask dictated. So it was a very sort of liberating prison.
It's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, as the book went along, I did have this idea kind of question, and what Pokey said kind of jogged my memory there. If each person's given masks that they're permitted to wear, at some point you start to develop as a person contrary to your mask and, you know, run the risk of the very serious crime of being unmasked for exploring who you might be contrary to the masks that you currently possess.
Yes. Yes. And in fact, a couple of the characters do kind of skirt that. And yeah, that's very much a case that, as well as that, it's a mechanism, of course, of social control, in that you have to decide who you are and then only be that person. And that tends to flatten out the way that people play out their identity. And you can only have an identity that's socially approved of. Again, I was kind of making outward explicit rules city for things that we have unspoken, unwritten rules about.
That kind of speaks a little bit to the concept of doublespeak and doublethink, as you know, introduced by Orwell, whereby controlling the language people can use, not just to communicate but to internalize thought, you really control what people think. And this is kind of an externalization of that same concept, it seems like.
Yes, it is.
But again, back to Pokey's point about how it's a liberating prison. At the same time, you can only be the mask you're wearing, but to be a different person, you have simply to change masks.
A concept that I came across in one of Philip K. Dick's novels, it's a German word. The word is Maschenfreiheit, meaning mask freedom, and it's the freedom that you have when you're wearing a mask, that you can be that identity without... You can be that identity without anybody contradicting it, in a sense.
Yeah, I think that's really interesting. But what X1101 was just saying strikes me as a little more nuanced in the book, because there's the characters don't really have the freedom that they would all desire to switch masks or change masks whenever they'd like, because there's not only an entire government apparatus set up around regulating control of masks and who can wear what mask and under what conditions, but there's a giant book of masks that catalogs and controls and keeps tabs on the amount of masks and the kinds of masks that have been distributed throughout the city, and to, you know, reduce redundancy or to be sure that no one is masquerading as someone they shouldn't be, or to keep appearing at the same time. So what started out as a sort of fanciful or farcical sort of tradition turns into a very stringent apparatus of governmental control.
Mm. Yes, very much. Yes, it started out as play, and it started out as freedom and license, and then it was co-opted, in a sense, as a mechanism of control.
All right, so I thought the one thing about it, it seemed so liberating that you could throw on a mask and just be who you wanted to be, but it seemed like a nightmare that you had to pretty much leave your mask on even when you're home. It said that many lovers didn't see each other unmasked. So yeah, just it seemed, that part seemed almost prison-like, where you go home and you have to leave your mask on. You could be completely undressed, but your mask is still on for most people. And that part of it seemed a little prison-like, like your own identity is just kind of in the coat closet and never can come out.
It also seems like a lot of trouble, because half the time I can't even be bothered to have pants on.
We didn't need to hear that.
Yeah, it's pretty much all mask all the time. Once you're in the city of masks, and I was definitely making a point with that.
So the other thing is, it felt like I don't know. It kind of place was the city supposed to be? Was it like an Italian type of carnival scenario? Or did you guys already talk about this?
Yeah. I kind of cite Shakespeare's Italy as my inspiration, and Shakespeare's Italy specifically because I get some twins in there at a couple of points, and there are a few other Shakespearean bits to it, but it's more or less Venice, which is traditionally associated with masks, only without owls, and the even the two factions, the personalists and the... two factions.
The characterists. Anyway.
Characterists, there we go. You guys have read it more recently than I have, although probably not as many times. The characterists and the personalists were loosely based on the Guelphs and Ghibellines, if I'm pronouncing that correctly, of Renaissance Italy, who were philosophical factions but would have street fights about it.
That is cool. Now, I just want to say, Mike, to you, I want to thank you personally for this audiobook. It's been one of my favorites since I found it, and I listened to this audiobook a long, long time ago the first time, and I've been holding off until it could be an audiobook club book, and I was holding off on that until we had a good crew that I knew would stick with a book, because I remembered it, the audio being a little muffled and maybe a little more bassy than it should have been, so I held off. But I do want to say that when me and another guy started the audiobook club several years ago, this book was one of the reasons that I started it, is just because I wanted to get people to give this one an honest listen and an honest discussion about it. So I thank you for the book and for coming on with us.
And I have to say, Pokey, either your memory of the quality of the book was off or a new version's been uploaded, because after you mentioned that last month, I went in, you know, intending to, you know, slog through it because it sounded like you thought it was a really good story. And I only noticed a few little corners that were a little odd. It was not, I was expecting not good audio, and I thought the audio was pretty good.
Yeah, I wasn't using very expensive gear, and I did have feedback from at least one person that they had some difficulties with the audio, but I think it may have been partly their gear. I listened to it on headphones, and fairly cheap headphones, when I was editing it, and it sounded fine to me, but if you're putting it through certain kinds of speakers, possibly, you might have not quite so good a sound quality.
Yeah, that's what happened to me, unfortunately, but it was my issue, not, I don't think, anything with the book.
It may just be the headphones that I'm using now, and I think the headphones that I had before were probably worse, because it wasn't nearly as bad as I thought I remembered it being. It was a little muddy at some points, and I noticed it more towards the end of the book than the beginning, so it might have been a fatigue thing as well. But it was not nearly as bad as I thought I remembered it being, and it was... even more enjoyable the second time through, maybe just because I had better headphones that were a little clearer.
While we're on the subject of the audiobook as an object, Mike, I'm wondering if you might speak a little bit about your decision to publish the book the way that you did. As you might suspect, our audience here is very interested in issues of free culture and related issues like that. And so I'm wondering if you might talk a little bit about your adventure in publishing it and your decision to release the audiobook the way that you did. Yeah, that's it really. I know I'm personally curious, and I suspect our listeners would be as well.
Well, it's going back a few years now. I think it was 96 that I did the audiobook. I can't actually remember why it was that I wanted to do an audiobook. It just seemed like a good idea at the time. And I thought, now podcasts are a thing. Surely you could do an audiobook as a podcast. And I did some quick Googling and discovered that I was not the first person to think of this. And in fact, there was a whole community over at podiobooks.com of people who were doing that. And so I hopped on that train and really enjoyed doing the audiobook, had great fun doing the voices. And although the editing was somewhat tedious. And what Podiobooks provided was a platform to make the work a bit better known. And I knew that it was going to be a minority interest. It wasn't going to be something that was widely popular, because how do you even describe it? But it was a way to reach a wider audience. And that's one thing that Podiobooks is good for. And they have a great community as well. People are very helpful. It's all moved on to Google Plus now. And in fact, it was Evoterra from Podiobooks who moved me onto Google Plus, because he basically said, our forum keeps getting hacked. We're moving to Google Plus. Who's with me? And I've met lots of other writers, including non-Podiobook people over there, and found it wonderful for my writing and as a source of support. So that's all worked really well. In those days, I don't think... Well, ACX wasn't operating, the Audible service where you can either do your own narration or get somebody to do it. And I don't know that Audible was really that open to people kind of coming up out of nowhere and saying, here's my book. So Podiobooks was really the place to be. But I think even if I was doing it today, I probably would go Podiobooks rather than Audible, because even though there's a smaller market and it's specifically free, although they do have a donation button, of course, I just kind of like the open feel of it and the indie ethic that's around Podiobooks, as opposed to the commercial ethic of Audible, who profit pretty heavily from your work. They take quite a large whack out of whatever your book makes. So for all those reasons, happy that I went with Podiobooks.
So talking about the open ethics and culture, can you tell us what license your book is under? Because I don't remember seeing that, and I don't remember hearing. Is it an all rights reserved, or is it one of the Creative Commons licenses that you license it under?
The text, both the paperback and the ebook are all rights reserved, but the recording is released under Creative Commons. I think it's about 2.5 in those days, and it's a non-commercial, the one where you can't modify it for your own purposes.
No derivatives.
No derivatives, yeah. Non-commercial, no derivatives.
It's amazing what you can do with a open framework like that and a good community surrounding it.
So did you discover Podiobooks after you had written the book, while you were writing it, before? Because I know that books are typically divided into chapters, but your story reads like a play. It has a dramatic pacing to it. And so I was wondering if your decision to go on Podiobooks and release the book episodically like that in some way influenced your writing and the way you conceptualized the writing process and how you segmented the book.
No, I wrote it first and then found Potio Books afterwards. The way the book is structured as a series of mostly diary entries, actually in some ways is not ideal for Potio Books. Chapters really work better because most people, when they are listening to a Potio Book, they want at least 20 minutes and preferably half an hour, even longer, as an episode. And admittedly, my diary entries are quite short, but it wasn't always easy to find the right place to break between them. It was a lot of fun doing the style, though, with the documents, the letters, the diary. It's a style that's been around for a while. Dracula uses it. But,
yeah, I was just thinking of Dracula.
Yeah, I hadn't actually read Dracula at the time that I wrote it. I only read Dracula last year and really enjoyed it. It's very well done. There's a reason it's a classic. But
agreed.
It's an interesting way of being able also to have multiple first-person points of view. The Diary of Celia, for example, the sister of the manservant. I went through and put those in actually after I'd done the main bulk of the writing, kind of as an alternative voice. And had a lot of fun doing Celia's unpunctuated, misspelled, rambling diary entries. And just in contrast to the very precise and stuffy main character who does his diary entries in a very formal way.
I thought that her diary entries were particularly, you know, interesting and amusing. A lot of our longer-term listeners will know or might remember, I listen to all my audiobooks at about 1.8 speed simply because I want to listen to a lot of stuff and I don't have as much time as I'd like to do it, and that's the way that I get my content in. And so listening to her at 1.8 was always amusing and entertaining.
Yeah, she's kind of at 1.8 to start with.
Yeah, yeah.
I thought that she came across brilliantly. You got so much of her character out of how her diary entry was read. It was great.
Agreed. And I was really surprised to hear you just say, Mike, that you inserted those in when you had come to the conclusion of the novel, because it's Celia that her voice concludes the book. So
yeah, it may not have been when I was all the way finished, but it certainly was not something that I planned from the beginning.
That's weird, because, wow, it just happened. Everybody left the room.
It almost looked like a net split, except we're on Mumble.
Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering what the heck that was.
Mike, are you
I may have clicked in the wrong place.
No, you clicking on the wrong place wouldn't have kicked Semiotic Robotic out like it did. You can take yourself out that way, but it wouldn't take someone else out. Not unless you're administrator.
Well, I'm back.
I don't know. That's weird, I guess. Oh, no, we're not hearing you now, Mike.
Better?
Yeah, I can hear you.
There we go.
Okay. Yeah, it's strange to hear you say that about Celia, that you didn't write her until the book was almost done, because earlier parts of the book seemed like they were it seemed like they were written around maybe the mystery of her. I don't know. I can't spoil it yet. I'll get back to it later.
It's hard. It's tough with this book.
Yeah. Actually, The book took me, I think it was about 10 years from beginning to end. And most of that time was the first three entries, probably sitting there waiting for what happened next. And it was only when I got a big piece of paper and drew a diagram of who was connected to whom and who was in conflict and who was in love and where all of the factions lay, that I found a way forward into a plot.
Oh, that is cool. So you didn't have like an outline of the story when you started?
Oh, not at all. I have gradually become more of an outliner. The book I'm working on at the moment, I've outlined pretty thoroughly. But to start out with total pantser, no idea what was going to happen next.
Oh, that's fantastic. So you're not a professional writer then?
No, I work in IT, don't we all? and I write in my spare time, but I enjoy it.
Wow.
I should say that I do have some training in that I have an MA in English, mostly language, but some 16th and 17th century literature as well, which is kind of where the feel comes from, I think, for the way the book comes together. And I was also a professional editor for a few years and then a technical writer. So I do have a background, but I don't as yet make my living out of writing.
It's always amused me going down that rabbit hole for just a moment, seeing people of kind of almost a generation ahead of me who didn't set out to be in IT, set out to do something else and then ended up in IT. Whereas people more my age, and I'm late 20s, start out knowing they're going to be in IT. And I just find that very, the differences are interesting.
Yeah, well, I'm 47. So when I was at school, IT hardly existed. We were the first class, I think, that actually had computers in the classroom, and they were the old Commodore VIC-20s. And so I did English because it was what I enjoyed and what came easily to me, and with no real idea of what it was going to lead to. And then went into publishing because that was the only job I knew that you could do with an English degree that was teaching. And since both my parents were teachers, I'd always sworn I never would be. and then gradually editing became more technological during the 90s, and I started to work with databases and ended up creating what in retrospect was almost a small ERP system for the department that I was working for in Access 95 with VBA. And gradually what I did became more and more technical until I kind of gave up and admitted that I was working in IT.
And let me guess, they're probably still using that ERP system written in VBA and Access 95 to this day.
It wouldn't surprise me.
There's a reason that we use the word legacy as often as we do.
Though actually that publishing company has now more or less closed down. It was bought by an international company, which has now basically shut down its New Zealand operations except for distribution and taken it all to Australia. So it really doesn't exist anymore. But if they were still going, they probably would still be using the database.
Or if they were still using the database, they'd probably still be going.
Well, that also is possible.
So how about your audio chops? This is the first time you've picked up a microphone, and or was this the first time you picked up a microphone and did any voice work, or had you had any prior experience with audio editing and engineering and recording?
I'd done acting classes and that kind of thing, but apart from a radio play recorded onto cassette when I was at school, it was the first time that I'd tried anything like this. I think I used Audacity to record it.
Yeah, Audacity.
If it wasn't that, it was something equally straightforward. And I got myself a $50 clip-on mic and sat down and read the book. It's a wonderful time to be alive in that you can do what used to be very high-end creative work that used to require a lot of fancy gear that cost thousands of dollars for really very cheap. And it's not that hard to do.
No, there's a fairly steep learning curve, but there's also plenty of people willing to help you, you know, and I don't know about back then, there probably weren't as many YouTube videos, you know, showing you how to get in on stuff like that. But were you involved in any other communities like IRC or anything like that?
Not that kind of community. No, I was in a gaming forum, but yeah, in fact, I think that was before YouTube. Difficult as it is to believe, YouTube hasn't really been around that long. So yeah, I think I got a couple of books from the library about audio editing and how to do recordings and podcasts, but most of it I picked up from Googling around and from making the mistakes and listening to the result and realizing that it hadn't worked very well.
Well, and Poke, you mentioned the learning curve. At this point, it's a learning curve rather than a financial hurdle. You know, the challenge now to producing and recording decent sounding audio is spending the time to learn a piece of software and to some extent buying decent equipment, but it's maybe hundreds of dollars of equipment, not thousands or tens of thousands of dollars of equipment and audio engineers' time and, you know, rented resources. Now, I mean, I'm here with, I upgraded to a $40 microphone and headset, and I've got software that's freely available to anyone producing, recording and producing, I would think, decent sounding audio.
Yeah, you sound great. People often compliment me on the way I sound. I have a $15 pair of headphones that I bought in the mid-90s and a RCA stick mic that I pulled out of a trash can somewhere. So, yeah, you're absolutely right. It's not the financial wall. It's just that learning curve, and you can learn it. It's awesome.
You've had Nathan Lowell on the show, haven't you?
No, I wish I'd do him. We've done one of his books.
Oh, God. And I think we've also done some books that he's read, not the ones that he's written, but ones he's read.
Yeah, right. That's right. We did Crown Conspiracy.
Yeah, that was my
question. Yeah. He did a lot of his recordings in his car because that was somewhere that he could go and it was quiet. I think he drove to a park in the early hours of the morning or something and sat in his car and recorded. And those recordings, of course, launched his career, and he's now making quite a decent living selling his books.
Oh, that's so good to hear. I wasn't sure because I hadn't heard from him in a while, but that's so good to hear that he's making a living at it.
Yeah, I haven't heard from him for a while. That's true. Maybe he's writing.
I'm going to have to spoil some stuff soon.
Yeah, I was going to say, X101's point about microphones is making me thirsty.
Yeah, I think that unless anyone objects, I think it's time for a beverage break.
Hey, you're the boss tonight. It's up to you, man.
All right, well, I'm going to run upstairs and pour my beverage so people can either hang out and wait for me to get back, or you guys can start your own.
Oh, I can wait. I'll wait till these guys get back. I got one that X1101 will like, and he's always got something interesting. I don't know where that guy finds his beers. He's always got good stuff.
Okay, I'm back.
All right. Now we're just waiting for X1101.
I'm back.
All right, awesome. All right, I cannot wait to hear what Mike has got for a beverage in New Zealand.
It's very dull. I have water. It's pretty much all I drink apart from fruit juice and milk. So I just have some nice filtered water. It's rainwater from our local hills. We live up against the hills where the water for the city is collected in the storage dams and treated, and it comes right down the hill to our house, excellent pressure, and we filter any chemicals out of it, and it makes for a very pleasant drink.
That's not dull. That's New Zealand water. You know how exotic that is to us?
That's like Hobbiton water.
Yeah, really?
No ants have been involved in the making of this water.
Oh, that's semiotic robotic. I bet you have something equally exotic in the other direction.
I don't know about exotic, but I have my usual cup of tea here. I'm sipping. Tonight's tea selection was Celestial Seasonings Sleepy Time Tea with Valerian Root. So it's got it's got a nice chamomile blend with a little valerian mixed in. Trying to, be mentally alert and have a book conversation and drink Sleepy Time Tea at the same time was an interesting dilemma I put myself in this evening.
Wait, Valerian Root? Is that real? That sounds like something out of Star Trek.
Hold on a moment.
I don't know if it's a root. I think it's a root, but somebody can correct me if I'm wrong.
It sounds like a brandy that Captain Kirk might have served to a diplomat or something. I have some nice Valerian brandy.
No, Valerian is it's an herb that is supposed to be relaxation inducing, and I don't know. It could be hokum, but it tends to work for me.
Taj,
what is up, fellas?
Pokey, if you check the chat, I've thrown in where I've heard valerian root before, and that's totally going in the show notes too.
Okay, good. So semiotic robotic, we had the tea versus not tea conversation that at Christmas dinner at my wife's parents' house as well, because we got a big box of Chinese food for everybody, and my wife's parents paid for it, and I picked it up, and it was way too much food, and I couldn't believe what the bill came to. And I asked the guy, I said, you throw in a box of tea with this order or something? And he did, and he threw in a box of tea, and it was not tea.
it was a tazon.
Exactly. And that's, we had that conversation at the dinner table. And normally my in-laws, my mother-in-law especially, who would look at me like I'm a BS artist, it was about to. And then my sister-in-law went, no, he's right. I just read the ingredients. There's no tea in here.
So what are you drinking, Pokey?
Oh, you're going to love this. I brought this just for you and saved it just for you. I have a bottle of Kentucky Bourbon Barrel Stout.
Ooh.
Wow.
It is not nearly as good as it was on tap when we had it at the Linux Fest. I was surprised at just how much I cannot taste the bourbon in the bottle of it. It's still very good. Don't get me wrong. It's still fantastic. But when we had it in that beer pub and had it on tap, it was almost like they poured a shot of bourbon at the bottom of it just to get the flavor into it.
It was basically drinking about a 10 proof bourbon is really what it was.
Yeah, that's what it tasted like. Now, this is a damn good stout, and their label says it all. It's a stout brewed with coffee and aged in oak barrels with Haitian coffee. And it says it all. It's very stouty. It's very dark, very creamy. It's not very thick. But it does have a nice, smooth coffee flavor to it, and not that like bitter, like black coffee or burnt coffee. It's just a nice, light, relaxing type of coffee flavor to it, and it is still very enjoyable. But I'm missing the bourbon flavor that I was expecting.
What about you, Taj? You got anything interesting for us tonight?
Well, I just got done sitting through a 3-hour online seminar course, so there will be no beverages, so I could make it through it without my bladder exploding, so I am beverageless.
Yeah, well...
Oh, you cut out semiotic robotic right at your punchline. We missed it.
I said that's a good reason to go beverageless.
I don't know. All that dry talk would make me thirsty.
All right, and I have a... Put it in the show notes so I wouldn't have to remember what it is. It is a black IPA from Stone Brewery, which if Stone makes a beer and you like that style of beer, buy it, because I have not had anything out of Stone that wasn't excellent. This is called Sublimely Self-Righteous Ale, and it is a black IPA.
That's an awesome name.
I almost bought that one. It was right next to the Bourbon Barrel Stout, and the bottle looked fantastic and the beer looked dark, and then I saw it was an IPA and I was like, I can't do it.
Well, and anyone not familiar, black IPAs tend to have the same kind of body as a stout, but then you get that sucker punch of hops there. And this is, you know, it looks like I've got a glass of cola sitting beside me. It's so dark. It wasn't very heady, but very hoppy and very delicious.
Cool. Very, very cool. So, yeah, I couldn't believe when, what was her name again? The girl who talked real fast?
Celia?
Yes. I couldn't believe when Celia didn't do it. I thought for sure she was the murderer.
I'll be honest with you. I wasn't entirely sure for a long time who was the murderer either. Apparently, Agatha Christie was the same way, so I don't feel so bad.
And I've read a lot of things that Stephen King has said, and at least with some of his stories, he's hearing it as he writes it for the first time. Sorry.
Stephen King is a very famous panter. That's one of the reasons why his stories often have kind of inconclusive endings.
And sorry for the Stephen King reference. I live in Maine up here in the U.S., and so he's, by most people's standards, he is just my neighbor about 2 hours up the road. So he's kind of considered a local hero around here.
I would imagine.
He looks like...
When the murderer was revealed to be the Countess, I have to admit, Mike, I was sort of let down because I was expecting that just made so much sense. You know, there was such a good fit there. And so I thought, oh, boy, is that going to be the opportunity for the twist, the great reveal? And that was it. That seems such a natural, obvious fit. I was thinking somebody like Salia or even Corius. But then there's a double twist at the end that just totally knocked my socks off. So. I, you know, got my enjoyment later on. So you sort of, I love the way that you've written the book to sort of, I don't know, in a murder mystery like that, one would expect the revelation of the murderer to be the great reveal at the end of the book, but it is not, right? There's two more twists at the end that seal the deal.
Yes, the first twist is that there was no twist, and then there are the two twists.
Yeah, that's what I was
going to say. Perfectly said. Yes, exactly right.
That's what I was going to say is I thought for sure the Countess couldn't have done it because it would be way too obvious. But then the reason why it wasn't obvious was not obvious. So that was very well done.
Yes, it displayed a very subtle hand. It was excellently done.
Bear in mind, too, that Gregorius isn't all that bright.
And he doesn't. Okay, now maybe this didn't come across in the text, but when he was reading his journal entry, the way he said his own name, he didn't sound like he liked himself very much. He almost said it with disdain or self-loathing, but then I didn't get that out of the text. But I don't know, maybe he doesn't think as highly of himself as he does his friends, for sure.
But he also doesn't.
No, he definitely doesn't. And when they're talking about stature and station, and he deliberately self-deprecates, and he's self-deprecating all the time, but when he deliberately lowers himself to make a point about being equal.
You cut out there real bad. You said equal, and you got about half the word out. You back?
Whew, I'm back.
All right. You said that he was self-deprecating to make himself equal, and that was the last thing we heard.
And then I just said that that's sort of a moment where, you know, you see his opinion of himself shine through.
Yeah, pretty much all of my heroes are outsiders. And Bess is, he's physically and mentally the opposite of me in many ways. But I took a lot of personal experience of being a bit of an outsider and used that to depict how he felt about himself and how he felt about the people around him.
Oh, I had a really good point to make about the way his sister recognized him, and now I can't remember what I was going to say. At least I thought it was a really good point. I don't know, maybe it'll come to me. It was really interesting how she, like right at the beginning, pointed out that, you know, he would be something if only he were ever challenged, and no one has ever challenged him because no one thought much of him, and no one thought much of him because he didn't put on a good face, and he didn't put on a good face because he was never challenged. So she knew that it was just an opportunity that he lacked, that it was all there inside him. And I think that was great how that played out slowly. I mean, so slowly that the fact that turned out to be a hero in the end really, really simmered throughout the whole book.
Yeah, it's no challenge really to have the big square-jawed, good-looking guy be the hero. Having the overweight guy who's not too bright be the hero is a lot harder.
I believe the only appropriate comment here is Excelsior.
I was going to say, wait, it sounds nothing like Hollywood.
I don't know. John Candy played plenty of heroes. Sorry, go ahead, Mike.
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I hate to skip so far to the back of the story. I hope we can come back if somebody else has a point from earlier on, but I was a little disappointed. I can't help it. I was a little disappointed that Gregorius was not more mournful of Corius, even though he never really knew Corius. It still, to me, it felt like a loss, and I was kind of surprised that he didn't respond that way.
Well, there's a sense, of course, in which he hasn't lost Corius.
Yeah, exactly. In the sense of the masks, of course, Corius has never changed to him, but it was strange. I don't know how else to put it. Sorry.
Well, I had just a logistical question there. Is when Juliana is relating the story of how Corius had died and she kind of assumed his role, but she was, I didn't really catch her profession, but I got that it was something akin to a tailor. But then Corius went on this seafaring journey, ended up coming back, and then Juliana just kind of slipped back into her life. Did nobody notice she was missing? There was no, I didn't catch any explanation of her being gone.
Yeah, I didn't attempt one. I kind of saw her as being freelance rather than employed. And if somebody disappears for a while in the City of Masks, you just assume they've been off wearing a different mask, I guess.
Well, I guess that does make sense. I hadn't thought about it in that respect.
Which was, of course, the case in this case.
I liked how the Countess had doubles for a while. She could be off somewhere else. That never occurred to me, and it should have, but it didn't. I don't know. Did it occur to any of you other guys that it could have happened that way, or were you as blindsided to as I was that, oh, look, there's a double to someone wearing her mask while she's off murdering?
No, I thought I didn't see it coming, and I thought it was perfect.
Yeah, that really floored me.
For me, it was one of those things that you hear him say that, and you're like, of course that's what they do. Why didn't I think of that?
One of the fun things about any speculative fiction is to work everything out to the ultimate logical conclusion. And I spent quite a bit of time thinking about, if you have this system of masks, what does that enable? What does it prevent? How are people going to game it?
Well, kind of like that.
Yeah, I'd love to see, maybe not a sequel, but like another story in the same setting where you have people, you know, wearing masks for which they do not have license, I think was Gregorius's words on the subject. But I'd like to, you know, hear a story of people who did that often enough that they could actually change their station life or improve it or you know, somehow be different, or maybe like the criminal underground getting away with stuff like that. I thought that was, even just the, when he asked about people committing crimes in the, was it the uncast mask? Is that what it, I forget what it was called now. Yeah. Even that was real interesting.
Yes, it was.
So since I missed the beginning, I don't know if this got brought up or not, and it probably did because we're all pretty smart. Did anybody else just hear the ideas about anonymity that we were talking about a few books back, just like in the back of your head the whole time? A metaphor for the internet.
No, it's a good point. But I wasn't here at the beginning either, but that's a really good point.
No one touched on that yet. But now that you say it...
I'm smarter than everybody, that's what you're saying?
Yeah, pretty much.
Well, you are the teacher, so we would hope so.
Maybe Semiotic Robotic could touch you.
You're too kind. No, I can't touch Taj.
He does have that smooth voice.
Mike, did that go through your head at all when you were writing it?
Not that I remember.
It almost seems like, based on when Mike said he wrote it, it seems more like a metaphor that fits after the fact rather than during. Because the internet becoming a real place of purposeful anonymity seems to be a more recent thing than in the early 90s. People were anonymous there simply because you were. It wasn't, people didn't go there to be anonymous.
Yeah, but then how do you make the more recent, the tearing down of all the anonymity fit that?
I didn't say it was a perfect metaphor.
Yeah. They're personalists.
I went to make a YouTube comment the other day, and my YouTube name is gone. It's only my real name there anymore, and I can't find a way to change it back or change it. And for the past 2 years, I've been telling YouTube I don't want to use my real name. I like the handle I have on YouTube. It's just gone.
So we can't look at YouTube anymore for Space Pokey?
No, I was never Space Pokey there.
That was a missed opportunity.
It was something that never occurred to anyone but you guys.
Speaking, I'm glad you brought up we're talking about the politics of masking and unmasking, but I really like the sermon about, well, just the sermon that the who was it again that ended up putting on the mask of the sun god?
Well, it was the sun god.
Thomas, is that what his name? I'm so bad with names in these books too.
Yes, Thomas.
And I agree. It was an excellent sermon. The way that it was, and it's so strange too, because I didn't listening to that, I didn't picture you sitting in your study laboring over that sermon for hours and hours and how it would fit the story. But I did picture Thomas sitting in his study laboring for hours in how to make his point, to sort of mask his point, as the case may be, in, you know, within the construct of another point. And that I did picture, and I totally bought into it. I love that. That sermon was fantastic.
Yeah, where did the inspiration, what were you trying to say there, Mike? What would you say motivated your construction of the sermon?
I think it was just what went in that place.
Or put another way, did you plan that thing out for days in advance, or were you just trying to make him sound like a pompous windbag?
No, I think by that point I had a pretty good handle on who all of the characters were and the kinds of things they would say.
And that was the kind of thing Thomas would say.
I didn't mean to say he sounded like he was pretending to be a kind of more what I meant to say, but you got the point. But that's really cool.
Yeah, it's a strange phenomenon with characters, and authors talk about how characters take over and refuse to do things or insist on doing things. And we know that they're just parts of our own minds, but it is quite spooky how we've constructed this. Well, it's theory of mind, isn't it? It's our basic social ability to imagine how other people are going to react. And authors just happen to be quite good at that particular social skill of imagining how a person who was like this would think and act and speak.
So would it make sense to say that the upper class is more likely to lean characterist, whereas lower classes are more likely to lean personalist?
Yeah, I think that's probably true.
Well, aside from characterism being the official religion, it also acts to prop up the existing system because...
Right, that's what I'm thinking.
You know, you are the mask you wear and, you know, that's who you always have been and always will be. That kind of idea inherently props up an existing system rather than being a catalyst for, you know, growing a new system.
Oh, I don't know if I can agree with that. I think any system is going to prop up the existing system. The people at the top want to stay at the top, and they're going to manipulate constructs in do so. So I can see where if you were the lower class, you would certainly see it as the system that's holding you down, but it's not the system itself. It's the manipulation of the system. So, you know, I think it's kind of a false positive.
Oh, I agree completely. I was just saying that the specific structure of that specific system lends itself to doing that particularly easily.
Oh, yeah. And it does show, you know, good writing that the people at the top used it as efficiently as they did.
Yeah, to be able to contort a system of play and turn it into an entire mechanism of social control, again, as we were speaking about a little bit ago, you know, that takes guile.
Yeah, it just seemed like the sort of thing that people in that position would be liable to do.
I really like the whole assassination attempt that this all gets built around, because, I mean, only in this story can you have that type of assassination happen. It's, okay, you put on that mask, you become God. I killed God. Come at me, bro.
I don't know. I thought Douglas Adams did it pretty good with the Babel Fish.
Fair point.
The Babel Fish is just awesome.
So maybe it was the masks then that when these characters put on the mask, they became the character of the mask. And the same is true for the city, where the city put on the facade of the glorious city and it became this glorious city. Maybe that's why I could visualize it so much better than I could in other stories, just knowing that it's all a construct, even to the people in the construct, and they all know it. And maybe that's why I was able to go along for the ride a little easier than I can with some other books. As far as setting is concerned, as far as the characters go, they were very well written characters, and I thought they shone through their masks no matter what.
Well, and I think that it's interesting that an entire city makes not just a social, but a social and political stance out of the willing suspension of disbelief.
And this would differ from anyone else, how?
Yeah, and I wouldn't say it's a willing suspension of disbelief. It was just a suspension of disbelief. It was mandated, but that doesn't mean you're willing.
There are plenty of people who believe all kinds of crazy stuff because of willing suspension of disbelief on their own. They don't need anybody telling them to do it.
Yeah, I mean, I drive 55 miles an hour on the highway all the time. It doesn't mean I'm willing to at 55 miles an hour.
It's because the man's keeping you down.
That's right, the man with the mask.
Suspension of disbelief is tougher to leverage against the characterist, though, because folks like that, well, I shouldn't say that. I was going to say they believe wholeheartedly, and they're completely invested in the system that says when you're wearing a mask, you hold nothing in reserve. You literally are that person. And so there's no reason to believe otherwise. But there is a little bit of a hedge there, because Mike says that, you know, sometimes the unmasked, or the uncast, rather, can do things that they become seen, right? So to go from seen to unseen leads me to believe that there's a moment when somebody can break character and point someone else out, even when they're uncast.
Oh no, if you break character to point someone else out, you're unmasked, and that's a problem. And that was, I liked how the law in this book was so closely tied to the religion that they practiced. So if you broke character, you're not only a criminal, you're a heretic as well. And that, you know, it weighs even more.
Yeah, if you become unmasked, then you're in all of the trouble.
Well, I also found, since we haven't really brought it up yet, I also found there were almost two dichotomies of religion. There was the personalists versus the characterists, but then there was also the sun versus the moon worshippers. And bringing that other element in was very interesting as well.
Yeah, I kind of wanted to introduce a gender aspect, and the sun versus moon does that.
Yeah, I hadn't really thought about it that way, X1101, but there is a sort of matrix where you can say, like, it's almost like D&D matrix, where you can be like chaotic neutral, chaotic good. You can be characterist moon worshiping, personalist moon worshiping, you know, characterist sun worshiping, personalist. You can sort of plot the different characters and their motivations on that grid.
Take a drink.
What's that, Taj?
Said take a drink. We had a D&D reference.
I was going to add to that. You could be true neutral and wear the mask of the innocent man.
And we waited just for you to make that too, Taj.
I'm not even the one that made it.
No, but we couldn't do it without you here. We hung on to it.
That's the truth.
It's been in the show notes for over an hour.
Damn it.
Why, you keep dropping off, Semiotic Robotic. Is that something going on with your network, or what's up with that?
Yeah, it's my network. For some reason, my net connection keeps dropping me, and my Wi-Fi connection must be spotty tonight. Sorry about that.
It's okay. It comes back quick enough.
I did take a sip of tea when I was supposed to take a drink for an obligatory D&D reference, though.
Thank you, sir.
I reached for an empty glass. My beer was too good.
I don't know how we're going to get our Star Trek or Star Wars references in here, though.
That's what the post show's for.
I already got the Star Trek reference in when you were chewing Valerian root.
Yeah, that was already... Max has been ticked.
You see, but that was really a Fight Club reference.
Okay, here we go. Star Trek, Star Wars, Marvel, DC, Doctor Who. I can't think of anything else we talk about.
BSG.
So say we all. And Firefly.
Oh man. So Mike, what do you know about fencing?
What anybody knows. I've never fenced, so I just know some of the terminology and what anyone knows from watching movies.
Yeah, okay. Cuz it did seem to play a fairly big role, but it wasn't, you didn't go into a lot of detail, so I thought that might have been the case, but I do enjoy a good fencing scene.
That was one of the scenes I knew fairly early on was going to be in there. There was going to be a chase across the rooftops, and there was going to be a sword fight.
Oh, Taj, I mean, Semiotic Robotic just had to leave, and we didn't get a chance to say goodbye to him audibly. Well, here it is, Semiotic Robotic. Thank you so much for being with us. It's always awesome having you on the show. Yeah, a chase across the rooftop is another one of those things where way early in the book, I should have said, hey, there's a chase on the rooftops coming, and I just didn't.
I didn't even know who was going to be chasing whom or why. I just knew that there would be one.
Well, you knew it was going to be Gregorius chasing, but yeah, who he was chasing, you're right.
Well, the architecture of the city is too perfect not to.
Well, it's kind of the other way around, if anything, but because I knew there was going to be a chase across the rooftops, I had to put the... I had to put the bridges up there.
Oh, right, right. Oh, man, I just had another point and lost it again. I'm doing not good tonight. The
beer must have been really good.
Yeah, it's like 8%, and that was my second one. Fortunately, I'm out. There's no more, so I'm not going to get any worse, I hope.
Of ideas or beer?
Oh, it feels like both at the moment.
Oh, let me check my notes. I think there was one more thing I thought I didn't see getting wrapped up, and I wanted to ask about. So they resolved the characterism versus personalism debate, but they didn't really resolve the moon worshippers still being illegal debate, or they did it in such a way that I didn't see it.
Oh, that's a good point.
Yeah, I think that probably falls in the same basket as characterist personalist, only less so. in that Thomas now has a voice in the ear of the ruler, and so can at worst suggest that the persecution against the moon worshippers be quietly dropped.
It sounds like the answer to all the problems in Bon Vidal is going to, and by the way, what a fantastic name. Excellent to hear it every time. It seemed like all of the problems in Bon Vidal can be solved by just giving the people a little more freedom.
Yeah, what I've come to discover as I've continued writing is that the seeds of the conflict, the seeds of the next conflict exist within the resolution of the previous conflict. So all of the things that are answers and solutions to the conflicts in this book, if I ever write a sequel, those are going to be the causes of the conflicts in the next book.
Oh man, if you ever write a sequel, I want to email.
Well, I have a mailing list.
Oh, right on. I'll get right on that. That's excellent. I know what I was going to say, is that I think that's one of the things that I love about audiobooks so much, is when I'm reading a book, I'm kind of a slow reader. So I tend to think about it a lot while I'm reading it. And I might have been able to, you know, pick a lot of these things out, you know, the things that, you know, might have been obvious or whatever. When I'm reading an audiobook, it's more like being a kid again, where I'm just kind of, you know, sitting on the blanket on the floor in my mom's room, and she's sitting up in bed reading to us as kids, and you're just kind of hanging out, listening and taking it all maybe for granted, as opposed to overthinking too much of it. And it just, a lot of times, I don't know, maybe it's not every audiobook, might not even be a majority of them, but this one certainly was that way, where I could just listen. The suspension of disbelief was no problem throughout this whole book for me. I just was able to listen and take it in. And it's one of those experiences where storytelling becomes what storytelling should be. And thanks so much for that.
Well, thanks for saying that.
Has anybody brought up the structure of the narrative, like how it's been done in journals?
We did, but I'm sure you'll have some interesting and new points to make, so go for it.
I don't know. I kept wanting it to be more narrative and less journal. And that's just a preference for me. I see why you would make that choice. It gives you some tools and some things to play with. But at the same time, like me, I kept wanting just for it to, I don't know, it felt like it didn't flow for me. Like it was a very stop start, which obviously because it's journal entries. But I think that was, if I had one big criticism of it, that would be for me personally, what it was, is that I didn't really like the journal format that much. Not to say that the story is not awesome. I love the story. To me, it seems very visual, so I kind of think of it more cinematically in my head. In the journal, kind of, it's kind of a step removed from that. So it was kind of hard for me to get into it. Once I got into it, I was fine. But it took a while for me to kind of get the gist of what was going on and kind of get into the characters through the journal.
Wow, I couldn't disagree with you more. I don't think I've ever disagreed with you this strongly. I thought the construct of the journal totally walked me into this one with like through the character. I couldn't have asked for a better way to be told this story. I'm sorry to disagree with you, but I loved it.
You also don't like Kurt Vonnegut, so.
Oh, that's right.
And coincidentally, nor do I.
That's the secret.
Yeah, journals, in a sense, that was a creative constraint. It was one of those things. It's the same as writing in first person as a creative constraint. You can only show what that character sees. And because Gregorius, who tells most of the story, is kind of an unreliable narrator in the sense that he doesn't always get what's going on, that was almost a deliberate creative constraint for me to make it a little bit more of a challenge to convey what was going on.
Right on. I mean, for me, it's a taste thing, I think, more than anything. Like I said, not to diss the story at all. I love the story. I really dig the book. It was just that was my one little nitpicky thing. And it's obviously me. That's the problem. And like you said, it gives you a different way of tackling the story, which is cool. Just wasn't my cup of tea, I guess.
That's absolutely fine.
Now, I liked the journal entry bit, not only because you only saw it through his eyes, and he was the only character who you were, well, he was the most interesting character for sure, but also that when the journaling was done through other people, it didn't reveal anything of the plot, which I really appreciated. And a lot of it was, most of it was just external views of the main character whose journal you were reading. So it gives you some insight into how his reality is slightly, I don't want to say altered, but I mean, everybody's reality is altered, but it gives you a little, a better foothold to find out where his perspective is, I guess. That's probably a really poor way to say that.
Yeah, the extra documents in a way are add-ons to enrich the story. Celia's journals, the letters back and forth, the play, which is a flashback.
The play was really fun too. It was amusing in its simplicity and how the guys like thought they were getting away with telling a story when it was just so obviously real people.
Yeah, I really loved the play. I thought that was awesome.
Like, oh, guess what happened to us yesterday? But it wasn't really us. Wink, wink.
My friend has this thing.
Yeah, and he met this girl. She lives in Canada. You wouldn't know her, but she was there. Yeah, it was, and it was so in context that all these people in masks need to tell a story from within a play. It was just, it was great. It was perfect.
I also really like the journal entries because even though I just said I didn't like it, I can't remember the character's name, the girl that talks really fast, because the running thing is I listened to everything at like twice or three times the speed, and I got to her point. I was just like, what is going on? I thought like my MP3 player had messed up. I didn't know what was happening.
Yeah, I made the same point earlier, Taj, because I listen to stuff at about 1.8 and it's the same thing.
If you read the written version, her journal entries are completely unpunctuated and just one long run-on sentence.
I would almost expect them not to even have spaces or anything in them, the way that things just kind of fell out of her mouth.
I was going to say it would be excellent if in the text version you had control over the kerning and that kind of thing, where you could, you know, space the letters out a little oddly, or maybe have some of them just be slightly higher or lower than they ought to be.
That had to take a lot of talent to voice record, because I know I would have messed it up like 20 times trying to get through it.
Oh yeah. Was each one of those done in, like, did you have to splice it together, or were those one full read? It must have been like several takes to get it, but did you nail each one a whole time once?
I think I did some retakes. What I did when I was recording was, if I messed something up, I'd just start again from before I messed up and then edit it out afterwards. So a lot of it was continuous takes once I got in the momentum of it.
How long did the recording process actually take you?
Oh, I don't remember now. It was a few weeks, I think.
Wow, that's fast for a book that length. A lot of people say it's many months.
Yeah, I think I had some time off and spent a few hours a day doing the recordings.
Okay. Are you married? Do you have family? Did that, what does your family think of this?
I'm married, no kids. So I think my wife is happy for me to be out of her hair some of the time.
Says every wife ever.
Yeah. And what is she, has she listened to the audiobook or read the book?
She's read the text, yeah. I had quite a few of my friends read it before I published it. They had some really good comments as well. I have some very smart friends, and we had kind of a book club discussion, I guess, when everyone had read it, and they made their suggestions and said, oh, it would be cool if, and I incorporated some of those things. I don't remember what they were at this distance in time, but I know that I did incorporate at least a couple of suggestions of things that they thought would be cool.
That is really cool. I thought for sure you were going to say you had them all read it before you showed it to your wife.
No.
I don't know. Most everything I do when I go to show my wife, I'm so proud of myself. And here, honey, check it out. And she just kind of looks and goes, I don't get
it. That's nice. Yeah. That's good.
Your online friends will get it, right, honey?
Try having a wife who's an academic. She just eviscerates anything I ever write.
Oh, everything you have is marked in red.
Looks like somebody went on a stabby spree on my paper.
My wife is a teacher, and for a year and a half, my sister lived with us, and she was a teacher.
I'm sorry, bro.
I was just wrong about pretty much everything.
How is that different than every other day?
Well, when I go to work, I'm not wrong as much.
My wife's a professor, and nothing makes her happier than if she shows me something, if I put like a star sticker on it or a smiley face.
That's awesome.
Yet when I show her stuff, she goes, yeah, okay, that's nice, honey, and just doesn't get it. Man, I hate to say it, but I can't think of anything else to discuss about the plot of this book. We had such a good conversation pre-spoiler, and we've spoiled everything, and I hate to think it's over. I love this one. It's absolutely one of my favorite books. I know I've said it three times already, but I'm not exaggerating. It's top three of all my favorite audiobooks.
I'm deeply flattered.
Well, and you know what? If that is enough to flatter you, I'll tell you, you're up there with, now I can't remember the name of the book. The Lester Del Rey book that was one of the first that we did on the audiobook club. Oh, I'll have to go look that up now. And like Nathan Lowell and Scott Sigler stuff. I mean, that's the company that you're in when I talk about, you know, audiobooks that are so much fun to listen to. And, dare I even say Mark Twain. There's a lot of Mark Twain stuff I've heard in audiobooks this ranks right up there with it. And I'm not exaggerating or blowing smoke when I say that.
Have you ever considered cloning yourself, Packy?
My wife would kill me twice if I tried.
Good, good. Well, I have a number of other books. They're not very like this one, though. But then what is?
Yeah, okay. That does bring up something before you go too far there. For our show notes, where can people get this book, some of your other books, and I don't just mean freely available like they are on Podio Books, but where can we buy your books and where can we find your other work?
All of my stuff is on Amazon. Most of it is also on Kobo, Barnes & Noble, and the like. City of Masks is on Smashwords. The easiest way to find everything that I do is to go to my Google Plus profile, because that's where I'm most active. So if you go to gplus.to/MikeRM, MikeRM, that'll take you to my Google Plus profile, and everything else is linked from there.
Well, excellent. I'll definitely get that in the show notes, and so our listeners can have a link to check that out.
I appreciate that if you would do that. X1101, I was just trying to type while he talked, but I seem to have lost my cursor in the Etherpad page, and I'm not sure what I have to do to get it back. I'll try closing it and reopening the page, because I can't get a cursor in there. But and also, thank you for finding Badge of Infamy was the name of the book I was grasping for. That was another book that, I mean, these two books gave me sort of the same kind of feeling, where the story was really interesting, the characters were really well built and well developed, and the whole time was this overarching feeling of politics being the master of everyone's decisions ultimately, and just the conversation that ensues when you talk about, you know, speculative politics. It was great. It was a real thinker. It's a real fun one to have a conversation about.
Oh, good. I seem to always end up with politics in my books. I'm not sure why. I'm not even, I don't think, particularly political. I'm certainly not involved in real world politics, but it just seems to be something that keeps coming up. I guess I'm just interested in the different ways that people organize themselves.
That's a really good way of putting it. I like that.
Well, one thing I've learned from working on projects for basically 20 years is that when people join together, they can do really interesting stuff that no one person could do. And if you think about free and open source and how people build on each other's contributions and so forth, it's there's a lot to be said for collective effort of various sorts. And the thing about politics is that it recognizes that that's important, but it isn't actually very good at it. And when you're doing something that's important in a way that's kind of not working very well, that's great story fodder.
Wow, that was a really good way to point that out about politics. And also, welcome to Hacker Public Radio. You sound like you've been here the whole time.
Yeah, I kind of, I'm not deeply involved in open source or anything like that, but I certainly appreciate that it exists.
So Mike, I guess the last question left to ask you is, what is the next audiobook we have to review?
Well, I'm going to suggest a book that's also on Podio Books. It's by, I'm going to have to look it up. It's by Mary Holland, and the title is Maker Rules.
Okay, cool. That's not one that I've heard of. Can you give us a brief overview of what we can expect? You know, like I said, without spoiling too much. I mean, obviously, it's coming as a recommendation on good authority, so I'm all in.
Sorry, I got the title wrong. It's actually Macho Rules. The concept is that it's a colonized planet. It's a space opera without the space. In other words, it's more like one of Ursula Le Guin's books in many ways. It's sociological speculation. And on this planet, they've discovered an alien or alien device or something. It's never quite clear, which links up people who are going to do well together into effectively families, and sometimes they're couples, sometimes they're groups of three. And it's not, initially you might think that it's polyamory, yay, but it really isn't. It's more about people working together and fitting together in order to achieve things than it is about family being multiple people married to each other. And it's the usual conflict of the central authority doesn't understand and is sending somebody to investigate and what's going to happen next. So that's Mary Holland, Maker Rules. And it's very different from a lot of what you'll read. As I say, it's not in space. It's on a planet, but it's not Earth. And there's not a lot in the way of technological speculation, but the sociological speculation is definitely there. The other author that it reminds me of slightly would be Sherry Tepper, maybe Raising the Stones or one of her books like that, in the way that it deals with the way that people interact, which, as I've said, is something I'm interested in.
Cool. That sounds like another deep conversation for the audiobook club. It's my favorite.
Yeah, the premise sounds awesome.
Government screwing up? Yeah, I can relate.
And in fact, the local government has kind of become corrupt and has been taken captive by narrow interests and, you know, the usual stuff.
Sounds par for the course.
Government's doing what governments do. All right, we shouldn't say any more about it till we read it, or listen to it, rather, excuse me. Thanks for that suggestion, too, Mike. That's great. I can't wait. So does that wrap it up, guys? You had any closing thoughts, anything else?
I think I've said all I have to say. Other than thank you very much, Mike, for coming on, taking time out of your day to sit and chat with us. And how is tomorrow?
Oh, time travel jokes.
It's not too bad. Reasonably sunny in Auckland, New Zealand, anyway.
What's the local time you have there?
3 o'clock.
A.M., P.M.?
In the afternoon.
Oh, all right, cool. And Klaatu has nearly no excuse for not joining us. Maybe he's working. That's the only reasonable excuse. He's got a nice job now.
I was about to make that same joke.
I've been waiting all day to make that joke.
You can explain the joke to Mike while my wife blows her nose here. I can't really key up.
Well, the joke being that it's Tuesday here and Wednesday there. So you're in the future, man.
Was it the time travel joke you wanted us to explain or the Klaatu joke?
No, the Klaatu joke. Oh, my wife just pinched the shit out of me. Sorry, Mike. Yes, we have a good friend who's from the States. He's probably, I think, from the East Coast, but he moved to New Zealand for work. And he was an audiobook club member early on, and he came back later as an author. And then Did he come on and review another book after we reviewed his? I don't know. I don't think so. But anyway, he's a good guy.
He's not been on since Taj and I started, I don't think.
Nope.
Yes, well, I normally would be at work, but I have a cold, so it kind of worked out well, although I had cleared with my project manager that I could sit off in a room and talk to you guys, but in the event, I was home anyway.
Oh, it's really nice of him. Thank him for allowing you to do that. If you hadn't been sick, I'm sorry to hear you're sick.
Yeah, I've had a cold now for 3.5 weeks. I'm getting a bit tired of it.
Oh, that's a long cold.
Yeah, it started at the beginning of my Christmas break.
Yeah, I had to get out of work 1.5 hours early tonight to make it here. I switched my job and I don't get out till 7 p.m., which is normally when we've always started the show. So, yeah, when X1101 wraps us up, we'll have to talk about that, guys.
No kidding.
Speaking of wrap-ups, does anyone have any final points to make?
I'd like to reiterate that I love this audiobook. I'll be listening to it again. I'm not going to wait as long between listens this time because first time I heard this was years ago. I'll probably listen to it again soon. Oh, and my mom loved it too when she listened to it.
I just want to thank Mike again for coming on. It's always nice to have the author on so you can we can pick your brain about what was going on.
My pleasure.
Well, then thank you everyone for listening. This has been the Audio Book Club for Hacker Public Radio. Join us sometime and enjoy an audiobook.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HPR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.
Port knocking.